Hello everyone and welcome to this live episode of Gutcast, the first podcast created for people living with IBD in Ireland, brought to you by Crohn's and Colitis Ireland and Janssen Sciences Ireland. Today's episode also happens to be our first live episode of Gutcast, so we are very excited to have you here. Do you want to give me a big cheer to let people know that you're here? My name is Amy Kelly, and I have been the host of Gutcast since its launch in 2020, having been diagnosed with Crohn's disease a year earlier. I'm a former board member of CCI and recently joined the team as the head of communications and fundraising. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the podcast. It has proven to be an excellent resource for people living with IBD in Ireland, a place where we can easily access credible, practical information from renowned healthcare professionals, and most importantly, hear from other people living with IBD and the challenges and triumphs they have faced so that their experiences might help others. For today's discussion, we will be talking about the future of IBD care, which I'm sure you will agree is a very exciting topic. We will be looking at the latest updates in medical research, plus the latest advancements in digital health that have the potential to really change the patient experience, enabling people living with IBD to better manage and understand their condition through the use of smart devices. To shed light on these interesting topics, I am joined by Professor Glenn Doherty, consultant in gastroenterology from St. Vincent's University Hospital in Dublin, and Seb Tucknot, who has lived with IBD since 2008, and subsequently started IBD Relief, a company which aims to empower people living with IBD. Thank you both for being here today with us.
This is a great pleasure, and thank you very much to CCI for the invitation to come along today. This is the first time I've ever done a live podcast, so it's very exciting. And great to have a real live audience in the room.
How are you, Seb, today?
I'm good, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and really nice to do one. It's my first face-to-face podcast and discussion, so it's really nice to actually be here and actually interact.
Yeah, well, we're delighted to have both of you here today, and I'm really excited for this conversation. And I suppose, Seb, to set up, I suppose, the conversation, because obviously we're talking about the future of IBD, but before we talk about the future, let's reflect. And I'd love to talk about, I suppose, your own IBD journey. If you could bring us back to 2008, or even prior to that, I'm sure. What has your journey been like?
So there's, quite a lot of story, I suppose, since 2008. Before that point, I didn't feel like I had really had any tummy troubles or had any sort of symptoms. Felt like I was a pretty healthy 21-year-old. I then went to the toilet and there was some blood in my poo. And I sort of first thought, that's not normal, what's that? Kind of thought maybe I've eaten something, so I kind of just left it a few days and it sort of continued. And then went to my GP. They thought I probably had a hemorrhoid, which I didn't quite fit with me. I was like, I don't think it's a hemorrhoid. But then my symptoms kind of got worse. I started to go to the toilet more frequently. It started to become more diarrhea, more blood. So I went back to the doctors again. This is all like within a week or something. And then they were like, oh, maybe this is something a bit more serious. Maybe we'll refer you to gastroenterology. And this was in the UK, if you didn't realize I don't have an Irish accent. And decided to go back to A&E again. I was like, I feel like I'm dying here. Like, what's going on? And then this time someone did a digital exam, which I know now the name of, which is where they put a finger up your bum. And he was like,
nothing digital about it at all.
A very physical exam. They then said, oh, we're going to take you for a scope. So they had a quick scope to see what happens. I remember breaking down in tears afterwards, kind of with a mix of relief of like, okay, I have got something and now we can deal with it and hopefully cure it, because I was completely naive about the process after that. But I thought that it would go away. But then also fear of like, I'm 21, I've now got this thing. I'd read stuff online that it was completely life-affecting, all those kind of things. So that was kind of the very beginning. I was fortunate that the medications kind of got things under control, and then sort of spent a few years trying to come to terms with things and get on with things. And it was, life-changing.
I love the way you say, just get on with things. You didn't just get on with things. You are really proactive because of what the line of work that you do now. You've set up IBD Relief. Can you tell us about that? Because that's a really empowering thing for someone to do.
Yeah, thank you. So I'd been living with sort of uncontrolled symptoms. I was kind of on and off different treatments and on and off steroids, and just things weren't kind of getting under control. That then it kind of hit a point where I was like, I need to do something about this. Like, this is, I can't just keep living this way. And that was when I ended up, for the first time in 5 years, actually, I joined a Facebook group with other people with IBD, because I was like, I'm going to go and sort of see what other people are experiencing. And from doing that, it then introduced me to this world of people going through what I had. And then I started to learn things, and people were like, oh, I've tried this or tried this. And it just like really intrigued me. I've always been a problem solver. I always liked to solve problems. And it was kind of, I was this big problem that I needed to now fix. And I hadn't really realized until that point that maybe I could play a role in this. And it also really opened my eyes up to actually how little people understood about what was going on and all the different questions and the repeated questions. Everyone was asking sort of similar stuff. And that's what drove me to set up IBD Relief. My background was in web design and marketing, so I knew there was better technological tools to like try and help people, and I hadn't seen those in the sort of healthcare space. I was surprised at how kind of behind healthcare was in terms of other industries when it came to digital technologies or use of like video or podcasts and things like that. Like, this just wasn't there 15 years ago.
I can appreciate that. And I think it comes from a place of just looking for more information. And, you know, I think that's what the podcast is all about. It's all about empowerment and trying to empower each other. Thank you so much for that. Glenn, if I can bring you into the conversation, you work as a gastroenterologist. So I'd love to know where that passion firstly came from for this area.
So the interest in the disease area, and I think this is common to a lot of people who maybe develop an interest in a disease, is that there often is a personal story. And in my case, my dad has ulcerative colitis, and I have a memory as a small child, you know, being in the car, traveling around and, you know, going on our summer holidays, and we kept having to stop so my dad could use the bathroom. And as a kid, I couldn't really, you know, maybe I was like 6 or 7. I kept, you know, every time my dad would get out of the car, I'd ask my mum, you know, why did we have to stop again? Or, you know, what's wrong with daddy that he has to keep using the bathroom like this? And so I suppose it made me aware at a very young age about Crohn's and colitis. You know, I know there's a lot of people out there who don't know or don't have an awareness if they don't have a family member, a friend, or someone who suffers with this sort of condition. And so I suppose that's part of the reason why I maybe developed an interest in it. And then I've always enjoyed research. I suppose I feel as a healthcare professional, like it's a hugely satisfying job that I do, and I have the privilege of working with a great team of people and looking after a lot of patients with Crohn's and colitis. But I also sort of feel strongly that, you know, you try and sort of think, how do we deliver a good service to people? Is if we're not working constantly to try and improve our knowledge and make things better, then we're not doing a good job as healthcare professionals. So it's all about trying to add to the knowledge and improve the service that we deliver. And so a few years ago I think it's 2015, 2016. I've been working for a number of years sort of within our own hospital and with my own colleagues. And then I sort of came to a conclusion that if we were really going to try and address the key questions, we need people to work together. I have a big group of patients who see me. I work with colleagues, but just in a single hospital or in a single centre, we're never going to generate the understanding that's going to help us to really try and find the game-changing information that we need. And so we set up a research network across the country to try and get gastroenterologists and nurses and healthcare professionals in different hospitals working together to try and, to some degree, put Ireland on the map a little bit as well in terms of IBD research, but also to get us then working with European colleagues and internationally as well. And so it's been very exciting to try and sort of build those relationships both with other people, other physicians and healthcare professionals in Ireland, and also then to work with colleagues internationally to try and, because I sort of think if we're really going to get there, we all need to work together and be pulling in the same direction.
Absolutely, we do. And before, I suppose, we discuss the future, because that's obviously the nature of this episode, I kind of want to take it back and even, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, how far have we come? Because I think it's really important to acknowledge how far we've come, particularly if there's anyone listening or here in the audience today who's perhaps newly diagnosed, or those, you know, who may have had has the condition for quite some time, and to be like, yeah, actually, we have come so far, or my diagnosis in the 90s is very different to how it is now. Or is there any change at all? Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I think there's been a huge change, probably even since you were diagnosed, Seb, in 2008. And the first major thing, like, compared to when I started out as a, you know, a trainee in gastroenterology working in a, you know, in various hospitals in Ireland, is the fact that, I mean, what's really transformed our care of patients with IBD is actually having IBD nurses. Like, I remember when I was first appointed to my current post, and we had a nurse who was sort of like a half-time nurse who worked in sort of cancer genetics. And then she did, you know, IBD was sort of like a sort of side thing that she sort of did. And, you know, I think we all appreciated that she was a really key member of the team. And it's taken a long time to, I guess, try and build the momentum behind the fact that, you know, IBD nurses are a really crucial form of support for patients, and that you can't really look after people meaningfully with a chronic illness like this without the impact, without the assistance of the IBD nurses, because they provide a lot of supports and a lot of things that we as physicians we're not good at doing. But I'd like to think the physicians have gotten better as well. So I think 20 years ago, I'm sure the experience of a lot of people was that, you know, you went into the room and the doctor spoke, you listened, and then, you know, you were given a prescription, you walked out the door, and, you know, it's a bit like, just go off and get on with it. I think the idea that we work in partnership with our patients, that, you know, we're there to, any treatment decisions that we make are made on basis of a joint decision making, you know, so we involve all the people who need to be involved. That's the patient, sometimes it's family members, sometimes then it is other people, other members of the healthcare team as well, dietitians, IBD nurses. And I think we've got better at that, and I think we can get better again. And I think empowering patients to be able to participate actively in the management of their own condition, I think is going to be an important part of the future. And hopefully technology will assist with that. I'd like to think. Congratulations, by the way. I just looked at your website this morning, but it's a great... I love the... Apart from anything else I do, I love IBD Relief. It's a great... Just the concept is, it's very attractive, and it's certainly something I'll be pointing my patients towards.
Yeah, and it is exactly that. But I think, you know, when in that conversation there, when we're talking about how far we've come, like, do you even notice, Seb, in comparison to your time of diagnosis in 2008, and, you know, comparison to now, I'm presuming you're speaking with patients who are diagnosed now. Do you see a difference in where we've come?
I think there's lots of improvements, which is amazing to see, and I think particularly around the treatments that are available. So the fact that we've now got, I don't know how many at the top of my head now, but 10 maybe new, very targeted, very good treatments that are helping people that maybe didn't have that help before. I think that's amazing. I think it's really nice to see, like you're saying, in terms of the support that's available and sort of understanding a lot more about it. It's still quite sporadic, certainly in the UK. Like, you kind of, some centres are vastly better than others, and there's still that, I think, trying to get more consistent care, I think, is hopefully what we're trying to work towards more. I think there's a lot more resources and things available. And I mean, even since I've been diagnosed, like, social media and stuff is massively different compared to 15 years ago. So sort of the support networks and the people talking about their own experiences. And I'm a big advocate of learning from other people's experiences. And I think we've got more platforms to do that, and that's more appreciated. It's really nice to see research being pushed on as well. I remember a conversation I had with when I was diagnosed, I ran my own business, and I used to kind of a joke, but it was serious. I would have a flare up pretty much every payday because I wouldn't have enough money to pay everyone, and then I'd be stressed, and then my stress would make my symptoms worse, and I'd have a flare up. And I remember going to an appointment with one of the consultants, and I said, "Oh, I really believe that stress is my problem, and it's causing me to have flare ups." And he turned around and said, "Oh, that's a load of rubbish. Like, stress doesn't affect this disease." So it's nice to see those things coming through. It's like, oh, okay, there is research to sort of back up maybe what we've experienced. And I think we know a hell of a lot living with this condition, and we notice little trends, we notice little things, and we have a lot of knowledge. And I think if we can share that with each other and with the people that are trying to make a difference, whether that's the doctor's research or whatever, then gives them more of an insight. I think we forget that we can play a massive role in this and really, really help things.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I know, like, within my role, I've kind of delivered a couple of talks with, you know, particularly students who might be studying in the field of medical research of some description. And I think it's always really important to reference that we probably wouldn't be here without research, you know, probably living well, but also the research wouldn't be there without the patient. And it's important to acknowledge not only to look at the condition, not only to research Crohn's or colitis or the various forms of IBD, it's important to research the person living with IBD and how it plays in their life and what do they want to achieve in life and what do they want to do, and, you know, have those, that communication, I think, is really, really important as well. Glenn, you'd mentioned there about the network and kind of putting Ireland on the map. How much on the map are we? Can you talk to us about, you know, the role that Ireland is playing currently in the area of IBD research?
Well, so I suppose, yeah, it's always challenging as a smaller nation to try and put yourself on the map. And, you know, we may have won Eurovision lots of times, but in the European context, we've a relatively small population. We're in a position where, you know, it's hard to compete with countries like France and Germany if they're, you know, if they do a piece of research and have a research network. So one thing we've tried to do is work with other small nations in Europe to try and sort of, let's say, make a merit of the fact that if we all work together, we can compete with the big the big guys. So we've developed a relationship with the national network in Portugal, and we've had a few joint meetings with them and joint projects, taken part in a few research projects with the Belgian IBD research group. So we've been building those kind of relationships with other groups of researchers around the world. We've taken part in big international studies. So there's a study called iCare that a lot of patients in Ireland have taken part in. And the goal of the study was to try and understand a little bit more about the long-term effects of a lot of the medications that we use nowadays. So 13,000 patients around Europe were recruited, and they filled in a diary every month. And so it's interesting what you say about, like, putting the patient at the center. So it was very much, the philosophy was the patients are the researchers. Like, so 13,000 patient researchers were involved, and to date, they've collected sort of 30,000 years of patient experience, these sort of monthly diaries that people were completing. And so I worked with my colleagues using our network to ensure that we had a good representation. So we had almost 400 patients from Ireland who took part in that study, and some of them have continued to do the sort of, let's say, complete their diaries for up to 5 years. And that length of sort of follow-up, like, that's what you really need to know. If you're going to be able to make an informed judgment about the long-term effects of a lot of medications, that's the sort of size of a study you need. Thousands and thousands of patients, you know, collecting information for months and months. And of course, without the technology to be able to do the electronic diaries, we wouldn't have been able to do that. I'd like to think we're putting Ireland on the map, and we're going to work hopefully in the future with Crohn's and Colitis Ireland to strengthen that and to make sure that the patient voice is strong in the work that we do.
No, and absolutely. That's a yes from us. but yeah, no, and I think that's great to hear that when you reference patient researchers, that's a term that just should be used. Like, it makes complete sense, and having that voice at the table, not consulted after the piece of research has been decided upon and, you know, processed, and then bringing the patient down the line. It should be at the table at the start of development, which is really, really important. Okay, it's great to know where we are on the map. Can you talk to us kind of what's happening right now?
Well, in terms of technology, I suppose there's a lot of what's called, like, big data sets. So these are both, say, genetic studies, where obviously now we have the technology to be able to sequence a human genome in an individual. You know, we can sequence all of the genetic code in an individual. And, you know, even 10 years ago, that's something which would have cost thousands and thousands of euros. Now that it's been scaled up and the technology is becoming more accessible, you can do that in hundreds and then thousands of patients. And it really starts to give us some unique insights into some of the genetic sort of factors that are important in how Crohn's and colitis, how they evolve, how they behave, how they respond to treatments. Then add on top of that, then I think we've in Ireland been in a very fortunate position to sort of lead out on a lot of the research looking at the microbiome and looking at how gut bacteria are really important. You know, we live with thousands of different strains of bacteria that live in each of our guts, and clearly we've evolved over many centuries and millennia with these bacteria inside us, and they're there for a reason. Clearly, we both benefit from the relationship with the bacteria that live inside us, but maybe dysfunction or a breakdown in that relationship is really important in understanding what happens in Crohn's and colitis. So I think there's been a huge explosion in research in that area, but one of the challenges is how do you change the bacteria in the gut? And obviously there's ways that you can do that using, you know, you can transplant one person's, you know, bacteria into another. That's been studied as a potential treatment for, you know, colitis, Crohn's disease. So there's strains of bacteria that are there, but it's also what are those bacteria actually doing inside us? What is their metabolism doing with the things that we eat? And how can we then sort of learn from that to try and, I suppose, personalize the approach to treating IBD in the future and hopefully maybe either curing or preventing it from happening.
I think that's really interesting to look at because there's so much around, like, you know, gut health has become such a buzzword now. And I think it's important to bring it back and, you know, to show the role it can play and the role that diet plays. Although diet doesn't cause IBD, it certainly has an impact. Of course, it has an impact. And I suppose when we talk about research, you know, naturally, everybody wants a cure. Like naturally, you know, everyone wants to hit that point. But until we get there, I suppose, obviously, you know, we're trying to make daily life better and to be able to live well with our condition. When you look to the future, what would you like to see? Or, you know, when you're talking to people, what would people like, whether that be like a high-tech watch or, you know, a high-tech like stoma bag or, you know, something, what do you feel would make life better in the digital tech space, I suppose, for people with IBD?
It's a big question. I think I've always been surprised at how little we kind of understand about our bodies, or in terms of the monitoring. So like, I mean, even worse now since COVID, but like I'm getting maybe a blood test and a stool test once every year if I'm lucky. And it's kind of, that's a tiny snapshot of my health. Like, who know, if I took a stool test multiple times a day, would it change in the day? Like, who knows? Like, I'm not sure we even know that stuff. And that always intrigues me. Like, you get in your car and your car can tell you all kinds of things about what the car's doing, but we have no idea what's going on in our bodies, and that seems a bit odd. So I think hopefully there's a place where technology can start to help that, whether that's if people wanted to, fecal calprotectin, like poo tests that you could do at home, like on a weekly basis or a daily basis, and that data goes somewhere that we can make some sense of it. I've personally been interested in looking at data that I can get from wearable devices. So like my heart rate, body temperature, I sort of spent quite a long time like tracking my sleep and sort of things. And I started to notice trends of like, if my heart rate variability, which is how your heart doesn't beat equally in each beat. So it's not like you have 60 beats and there's one every second. It's actually, they vary. And the more variance you have, the healthier you're actually, or the less stressed you are. Like, that's actually good. When I sort of, and it's quite a well-documented measure of like stress now, when I sort of was looking at that for a few years, I could see when my heart variability changed, then I would probably be more stressed at work and all those kind of things, but also my symptoms would get worse. So it kind of, like, it's not robust, it's just my own research, but like I started to sort of see trends, and it's helped me understand things or give me early warning signs of like, oh, okay, my sleep's changing or my heart rate's changing or something's changing in a negative way. I probably need to do something about my life to sort of change that. And sort of, rather than acting on in the past, it would be like, I'm bleeding again. Uh-oh.
Now the early intervention, nearly kind of side of things.
So I think sort of understanding more about that kind of stuff. I think beyond like digital stuff, I think I'd love to see a lot more about education, like understanding. I'm a big sort of advocate of helping people understand more about what's going on, what they can do for themselves. Those things I'm really fascinated about, is to what can people do, or how can we help people now? So like, what's going to make a difference to my life today or tomorrow? Like, yes, it'd be great to have a cure in the future, but that might be 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, who knows? I want to feel better now. So what, even if it's little things, and I've sort of found lots of tiny little things that all add up to make I feel healthier and happier now than I've ever done in my life. And that's all from sort of things that I've learned through trial and error and from learning from other people and all those kind of things. So yeah, how we can share knowledge, use research to kind of guide people in those kind of ways.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, because it ties back to looking at the person as a whole person and not just the condition. Because like, I do even think when I look to the future and, you know, exactly taking part in day-to-day life and, you know, not putting things on hold, even like simple things like the symptom of diarrhea and how restricting that can be for somebody and how isolating it can be, keeping somebody at home and not being able to actually partake in society. And I think even if, you know, that one symptom alone could, I suppose, you could be told, if you take this or if you do this, you know, that symptom will stop for you. And just the positive impact that would have on people's lives and those around them and your work life and your college life and, you know, milestone, you know, all of these kind of knock-on effects that I think research does need to take into consideration. Is that, do you find, Glenn, that that's happening now in research, that they are looking wider than just, I suppose, the illness, the symptom, this has to, you know, that kind of way that...
Yeah, I think definitely the agenda has shifted a little bit, and there's a recognition that, you need to think more in a whole person way. So say, for example, the psychological kind of factors that are important in the disease and also in then just how people learn to live with the disease or how they cope with it. I think people recognize much more now are, it's a key part of sort of the interventions that we need to sort of examine. And once again, it's all about trying to, like, I think it's a really key point that Seb made about trying to, you know, spot for an individual person, an individual patient. It's a bit like you're trying to do what we call personalized medicine. So almost where each patient has their own individual care plan. And we know that, you know, for Seb, when, like, you know, stress is his big trigger. So, you know, we sort of maybe monitor slightly different things in his case than we would in somebody else, and try and sort of spot, you know, with that sort of philosophy of prevention is better than cure, try and spot, yeah, here Seb's heading for a flare. Let's, you know, do XYZ, make some lifestyle changes, but maybe also then let's, you know, empower you to say, okay, yeah, you take some extra treatment for a while to try and prevent this from kind of happening. And trying to do that then in a personalized sort of way. And then hopefully in the future, if we are able to collect all this kind of genetic data and data about people's bacteria, then we'll be able to say, yeah, and, you know, the right diet for you
becomes a little bit more streamlined, essentially. Yeah, because I think, I don't know if you find it as well, but I find that those living with IBD have like a certain baseline of pain threshold. And I even find when I'm talking to my medical team, I probably downplay how bad I actually feel, or I was really bad yesterday, but I'm actually grand today. You know, this kind of stuff, you know, and you can kind of have this wave. And I think it's important to be like, no, I know my body. I know that that's not right.
Like, obviously, we all hope for that day when, you know, there's a cure for Crohn's and colitis. But I think, you know, being realistic in terms of the knowledge that we have at the moment, there are probably intermediate steps that we have to aim for first. Like, you know, I think understanding more about the disease and sort of what causes it and how it evolves. There's some really exciting research ongoing about the trying to sort of predict who's going to develop, say, Crohn's disease in particular. We sort of now know that there's a prolonged period before people start to get symptoms or any sort of problems where changes in their gut, probably for several years before the sort of disease comes to the surface, and trying to sort of identify these people who have pre-Crohn's, or I don't know what you might call it, but to try and sort of intervene at that sort of early phase and potentially maybe really sort of modify the course of the disease, then trying to sort of prevent flares, prevent people being hospitalized, prevent people needing surgery.
Yeah, I think so. What Glenn said there, there's definitely a lot of hope for the future. And I think that's really nice to come out of this episode, you know, around the future of IBD. There's definitely a lot of hope there. My last question for you would be just in regards to bringing it back to the patient, bringing it back to the person living with the condition. How important is it for that, you know, patient involvement? And, you know, do you have any, I suppose, advice or anything that you'd like to get across, I suppose, to have that?
I feel we all can play a really important role in helping this. And I think there's a hell of a lot more people living with IBD than there are actually working on IBD. So we outnumber the experts. And we can help share those experiences. And I've said it a few times already. And I think we can help each other as well. I think I'd like to see a lot more future of actually how we can help each other in a more structured way. I'd like to see a lot more research onto sort of the psychological and the mental impacts of IBD, and I think that's still really not understood maybe by the patients, but maybe not understood by the healthcare professionals, and the effect that all those things have on day-to-day. And like you mentioned, like food, I was terrified of all fiber for like 6 years or something, and like I just ate like chips and cake and biscuits and things, and I now that I understand more about it, actually now my diet has got quite a lot of fiber in it, and it doesn't kill me, even though like a few years ago, or 10 years ago, I'd been like, even looking at a tomato would send me running to the toilet. So it's made me really realize how many psychological things like impact stuff. And I think the psychological side of things, I think, is where patients can play a really important role of like sharing our experiences with each other, but also with research and help guide the things that are going on. I got invited to a research meeting thing with a research team in Cambridge. There's like 20 of them. They've been working on IBD for 10 years. It was the first time they've ever met a patient with IBD. And I was like, wow, like it kind of, now I've done this a lot, it didn't surprise me, but it should. Like it's kind of, and just by talking to me, and there was another patient as well, like just talking to us for like, well, the whole day, I suppose, but like in bits and pieces, they were like, oh, I didn't even think about that. And they were so focused on the genetics and the sort of molecular level stuff that I didn't quite understand, was trying to understand. But they hadn't pieced together that actually that tiny little bit of my gut was part of an entire person, and what impact like my job and my life and the relationships around me and all those things have on my life. And actually, that's where I think if we can start to do that and be brave and get involved in these kind of things, go and I love it now when I manage to get sort of encourage people to come and get involved in like focus groups or steering groups or go and get involved in research, and some of it you can get paid for as well. So like there's benefits, like you can actually, well, like you're now working in IBD, and I think the people that are working actively trying to help the IBD space can really help shift the difference, and we get it, yeah. So we can really make a difference.
Well, great. Thank you both so much for everything you shared with us today. Very much appreciated, and we'll see you at the next event.
The views, information, or opinions expressed during the Gutcast podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not represent those of Crohn's and Colitis Ireland or Janssen Sciences Ireland. Contributors received payment for their time recording the podcast. The primary purpose of this podcast series is to educate and inform and is not a substitute for professional diagnosis or treatment. This podcast is funded by Janssen Sciences Ireland.